So yes, what I'll be talking about today, you can see up there, is U.S. honeybee populations. And when I use the word importation, I kind of realize that to some extent that we could be talking about Australian bees coming in next week or something. But I'm not really talking about that until the end. It's more of a historical perspective and some things about breeding practices, but I'll have to also mention Varroa. All right? Okay, next slide. Okay, well, if you think about the settlers coming to the New World, the European colonists, what they found was, you know, a vast, seemingly empty place, except for all the people that were already here, I suppose. But what they didn't find was honeybees. So honeybees are not native to the New World at all, the genus Apis, and instead they brought their honeybees with them. The honeybee, Apis mellifera, has a fairly interesting distribution relative to the other members of the genus. It is, it's over here in Africa, Europe, and Western Asia, and I'm going to never touch that thing again, okay? And the rest of the genus occurs over there in Eastern Asia. And within this vast range, a number of climates are... the bees actually exist within a number of climates, and as you might expect, have developed a lot of adaptations to those. And this is not moving. I did something wrong, didn't I? Try that. Okay. Just to give you one little hint of what we know of European subspecies of the variation within the honeybee. These subspecies names, Mellifera, Ligustica, Carnica, that you see there, are subspecies believed to have arisen following repeated glaciations in Europe, where glaciers forced the populations to be in small refugia. The glaciers then retreated, as you can see here, and what we now recognize as subspecies arose, in some cases, like Ligustica and Carnica, they're being more or less hemmed in by the Alps. In the case of Mellifera, spreading all throughout northern Europe, eastward to the Ural Mountains. Okay, so the endemic range of the species is allopatric to the rest of the genus, and I should mention that the rest of the genus are about 8 or 9 other species. Africa, Europe, Central and Western Asia is the homeland, and there are 26 recognized subspecies. Here you can see about 25 of them, and kind of ignore that tectonic activity that moved Africa so far away from Spain. I don't quite know what went on there, but anyway, there are a number of subspecies related to Mediterranean islands and the ones that you saw there in Europe, and a number in Africa, not so related to glaciation, but to other vegetative shifts and climate changes in the last, certainly less than a million years. But that's kind of what we had to work with when Europeans now decided to leave Europe and go to the New World. Oh, just one little aside here. Those three stars over in the right are in the Tian Shan Mountains of Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan there. And this is the homeland of apples, and also fairly recently described a subspecies occurs there. So this entire issue of allopatry and the native range of Apis mellifera is still kind of a topic of investigation. Okay, but so what about the history of the introduction of honeybees to the New World? Well, first we had European settlers from Western Europe arrive in the New World, so they brought their honeybee. They brought Apis mellifera, the dark bee of northern Europe. Also, other common names are the German black bee and names like that. And we know that they were established in Virginia by 1622. Once they were established, they were, as far as we know, kind of the only bee in town, because it was really expensive and difficult to bring other subspecies over in the days of sailing ships. And we have no records of any other subspecies being brought into the United States for about 230 years. One thing about this honeybee is it spread out rapidly in advance of the European settlers, and certainly within the eastern U.S. and fairly far west, colonized and established a pretty substantial feral population. About 230 years after that, additional importations began, more or less about a decade following the development of steamship service between the New World and the Old World, and it took a shorter amount of time, and I presume was probably cheaper to get things back and forth. And it also followed a wave in Europe of attraction and excitement about subspecies that were being brought into Europe from around the Mediterranean. And we know that seven additional subspecies were introduced between 1859 and 1922. In 1922, following the reports of the discovery of the tracheal mite in Europe, the United States restricted further importation of honeybees from outside the United States, and it kind of worked until about 1984. This was the first subspecies that was brought in. After that, this was the Italian honeybee, Apis mellifera ligustica, and it's kind of hard to probably describe the excitement at the time of this new bee. It was yellow, it was considered beautiful, it was gentle, it appeared to be resistant to diseases, the diseases they knew about at the time. And this bee and descendants of this bee are the predominant honeybee of commerce now within the United States. I think the majority of beekeepers, especially these commercial beekeepers, are maintaining some variant of Italian honeybees. And here are the records. These are based on records in bee journals at the time of people that of either expeditions or people that brought them over and had them for sale of different subspecies. And I just have the trinomial name there. So the first one's Apis mellifera mellifera, then Apis mellifera ligustica, and so on. You can see that those eight subspecies that were brought in all before 1900. And these included some kind of weirdos and very cool ones, like Lamarckii from the Nile River Valley, and Cypria and Syriaca, which were both from what's now Palestine and Cyprus. And down there in 1990, we have the African subspecies Scutellata. These are descendants of Scutellata, of course, that came into Brazil in the 1950s and migrated their way into the United States in 1990. So that's kind of the history of what we have. Okay, and this introduction of honeybees actually represents sort of multiple genetic bottlenecks. Okay, first, we know that only 9 of the 26 known subspecies were ever introduced. And for each of these 9 subspecies, it's likely that only a few tens or maybe a few hundreds queens were ever brought in. It's just simply too expensive. Once they got here and you could propagate them, it was much cheaper to buy them from, Bob down the street than to try to get them back from Bulgaria or something. And then the other bottleneck would be the subsequent population expansion and genetic drift in the New World. By 1945, it's estimated there were about 5 million colonies in the United States. Now there's, 2.1 to 2.3 million. Okay, so that's the introduction of those founder populations. The one thing that I want to mention now, just several slides that I feel like I have to, is the overall reduction of the feral and commercial populations by Varroa destructor. So as you guys have already heard, after 1987, once Varroa arrived in the United States, this mite is believed to be responsible for the widespread decline of the feral honeybee population. Increase the sort of annual losses that beekeepers have to deal with. You heard in the very first talk today that beekeepers have gotten quite good or quite used to replacing colonies that are lost over the winter or that die for whatever reasons. And so that itself, constitutes basically another stepping up or ramping up in this sort of bottlenecking effect. Now, if you think that the loss of the feral populations was trivial, it may have been, but we do have some interesting data. And these data, and some that I'll speak of later, are from a student of mine who just recently finished, Debbie Delaney. And this, there's not the take-home message from this slide. If you look, I don't have a pointer, but if you look over there in Arizona, you'll see that a number of those M haplotypes, these are mitochondrial haplotypes, and by M, what I mean is they're haplotypes that are characteristic of that Apis mellifera mellifera subspecies or some related subspecies that were brought in. Basically, they're not maintained commercially. They were never, you know, no one now, for the most part, believes that they're keeping the dark bee of Northern Europe in the United States. But in Arizona, for example, the frequency of those M haplotypes was about 65%. And throughout all of the South, in this feral population, the frequency was around 30% or 33%. And I'll just tell you, kind of getting ahead of myself, that frequency is very, very low in the commercial populations. In the commercial populations in both the South and the Western U.S., the frequency was less than 5%. So this feral population that we did have represented most likely a significant source of genetic variation that has now been lost because of the varroa mite. And these are samples in the freezer from 1980 to 1991 that were collected during that time. So I don't know if there's Nosema serrani in them. Anyway, so the part that I'd like to concentrate on now, kind of the main take-home crux message for this talk, is that we have a small number of breeder queens that are being used to provide the replacement queens for our commercial populations even now. Probably smaller than you might imagine. Okay, so here's the queen, you know, the kind of thing that is so important to beekeepers. You know, if you have a half a pound of bees in one of these, you can kind of make a colony, and maybe a month or two later you can get $150 for it over in California, you know? So queens are the big thing. And beekeepers can make queens by, you know, taking a colony and dividing it and leaving one half queenless, and they'll raise themselves a new queen. But actually, what kind of happened, and this is so true with so many things in beekeeping, is someone figured out long ago a different system. So a person named Doolittle published in 1888 Scientific Queen Rearing. And what he figured out was that you could take wax cups, or nowadays we use plastic cups oftentimes, and you could graft a larva, a young larva just hatching, you know, that just hatched, and put in that wax cup or plastic cup. You can then put a whole bar of these, or multiple bars of these, in a very strong queenless colony that you're feeding, and they will raise new queens for you. So each of those cells there now contains what will become a virgin queen. You can then take these virgin queens, or these queen cells, and put in these little small colonies here, like these in Turkey, and you know, raise thousands of queens from a single queen. And then they can mate with, you know, hopefully you've provided a few large colonies here that might provide the males for mating, and you can get adequate mating, hopefully. Okay, so that was a great boon, because now, you know, one operation you make tens of thousands of queens for sale. Okay. Just a little bit of background here. The commercial queen producers in the United States are located primarily in two regions, California, which I think hereafter is called the West, but maybe California in some slides, and the South, you know, kind of the Southeast, more or less. Each of these dots represents a queen producer, and who may sell from a few thousand to 30 or 40,000 queens or more per year. And this is just a picture of a queen producer from California, and these large colonies in the front are what they're making queen cells in. Oh yes, So what I wanted to say was, back in 1991, 92, or is it 93, 94, I think, 93, 94, myself and a postdoc at the time collected samples from the commercial queen producers in the United States. We wrote them all. We actually probably collected samples from about 80% of them. And it was our way to kind of sample the commercial population. One way that you could do it would be to try to visit every beekeeper in the United States and take a couple of queens. Another way is to go to these queen producers and sample daughters from their queen mothers, okay, the mother queens that they're using to do the grafting. And that's what we did. And this is sort of a survey data from these queen producers. And what you see is that in 93 was, you know, we collected the West, and 94 we collected the South. So that's why it's over a two-year period. But these queen producers used 603 queen mothers to produce about 900,000 queens. And if you figure that we have 2.3 million, now we probably had about 2.5 or 2.6 million back then. Those 600 queen mothers were producing daughter queens to replace or requeen about one-third of the colonies, the managed colonies in the United States. Okay, so that seems like a genetic bottleneck. This is Debbie Delaney. She did a parallel collection of samples in 2004-2005 from the West and the South also. You know, let's see what's happened. Maybe we've learned something, or maybe things have changed. Actually, it's exactly the same. What she found was that beekeepers were using about 473 queen mothers to produce about 900,000 queens. Kind of the same deal, except now if there's only 2.1 or 2.3 million, it's actually a greater proportion. So basically all the queens that they were selling were coming from a fairly small number of queen mothers. And this works out to be about 1,800 daughters that are sold for every queen mother that's used. Okay, well, that's interesting in itself and maybe surprising, but what does that mean? And is there actually any measurable effect of this on the genetic diversity of the bees themselves? And with Debbie's work, we're actually able to use some more sophisticated genetic markers to kind of look at this question, microsatellites. And also the, let's say, more primitive markers that we used back in the early 90s of mitochondrial DNA. So in 1994 in California, in these commercial populations, you can see that these three different C haplotypes, which, by the way, are just markers that are predominant in Italian honeybees, Carniolan honeybees, and Caucasian honeybees also. So these are markers that are predominant in the honeybees that are preferred commercially. And you can see that only 3% of those commercial bees that we sampled actually had the marker from Apis mellifera mellifera, right, the dark bee of Northern Europe, which you recall was about 70% in Arizona feral colonies and about 33% in all the other states looking in the United States. 1 minute? Okay, excellent. Okay, 10 years later, we have, C3's disappeared, and, that's not so impressive. If you compare this to the feral population, you see that there's extremely extremely more diverse population at the time. The more interesting data really are these microsatellites. So in the West, in 1994, there were 128 different microsatellite loci alleles present in the 10 different loci that we looked at. And in 2004, only 92 of these were still around. So it was a loss of 36 alleles, which is about 25% of the alleles seem to have been lost in a decade. The South, we have more or less the same thing, 100 different alleles, and 76 were found 10 years later. However, okay, so it's about 25%, and we could estimate that this, or we could guess that this is possibly due to these bottlenecks or genetic drift caused by varroa destructor or the breeding practices. However, we did find new alleles. So there were 23 previously undetected alleles in California, which causes the net reduction to be about 10%, not 25%, and 20 previously undetected alleles in the southern population 10 years later, about 6% loss. Where do they come from? They could come from Russian. These new Russian bees have been brought in. They could be from people bringing bees in their pockets. They could be from Africanized bees. Or they could be because the beekeepers now in these locations are exchanging genetic material. And we actually looked at this using data that we had from South America and Africanized bees and other places. And we were able to at least identify some of the sources of these new alleles. In California, the 23 new alleles, 8 of them actually were from Africanized honeybees. 2 were from the feral population, which we now presume no longer exists. And 3 were from the south that had been brought over, and 10 we don't know where they're from. And you can read the same thing from the south. But basically, you can see that about 15 new alleles appear to have been contributed to the commercial population from Africanized feral populations now that we don't have it. So this is sort of the conclusion that this we sort of ameliorated the loss of genetic diversity. However, there's no longer likely to be sort of free sex allele diversity in the future, at least from European populations. And how can we counteract this? We might import additional stocks, and we may alter breeding practices to reduce this annual severity. And there's some things that we could think of for that. The very last slide. Consider germplasm imports from the old world, and it would be likely that for breeding purposes, we would find more variability by looking at samples from the old world rather than other founded populations such as Australia, New Zealand. And other sort of management techniques that breeders could use would be to increase the number of drone mother colonies they use and increase this sort of resampling between the eastern and western population. So thank you very much, and sorry to run over.